I'm sure other people will trickle in, but good morning, everyone. Thank you for joining us. My name is Elijah Wolfson. I'm a health and science editor at Quartz. If you don't know what that is, it's an online publication. It's part of the Atlantic Media family of media outlets. And as you know, we're here to talk about basically how the people, the groups of people who are most vulnerable in the best of times, so like women, children, minorities, refugees, indigenous people, are also the ones who are already suffering the most from climate change impact and climate change-related disasters. And it's a huge problem that is obviously going to get worse in the next few years, no matter what we do to mitigate how fast climate change continues to happen, the environmental health and justice issue is already growing. There's also really no simple solution because of the fact that it's an issue that's global in scale, but and so requires the type of international cooperation that's really difficult to organize and manage, but also really local in the way it impacts specific groups of people and individuals, and so requires a really nuanced understanding of local people, politics, regional cultures, and things like that. The three panelists we have today all have experience kind of bringing those two pieces together in the reporting and policy work, and I'll let them do most of the talking today since they're much wiser than I. So I'll introduce them briefly, and then we'll just sort of start the conversation. Alicia is, among many other things, co-founder of the OASIS Initiative. That stands for Organizing to Advance Solutions in the Sahel. The Sahel region of Africa is an area that is facing very dire threats of drought and desertification, brought on in part by global climate change. And the OASIS Initiative's mission there is to try to avert the humanitarian catastrophe that is threatening the area. Ian James over here is an investigative journalist who writes about water and the environment for the Desert Sun, based in Palm Springs, California. His award-winning 2015 series and multimedia project, Pumped Dry, The Global Crisis of Vanishing Groundwater, investigated the consequences of the emerging crisis in California, Kansas, India, Peru, and Morocco. Ian continues to report regularly on how environmental and climate change threats are putting Californians in peril. Priyali Sir, over at the end over there, is an award-winning journalist and documentary filmmaker whose work focuses on human rights violations, in particular LGBT and women's rights. Among many other things she's reported on over the years, Priyali has written on human trafficking of climate change disaster survivors and on the complex issue of climate change refugees. When we all spoke on the phone over the past few weeks, one issue that came up fairly regularly was how to actually define climate change disaster. It's sort of it's more complicated than I think people would think on the face of it, because there's a number of types of climate change disasters. There's sort of the immediate big weather things that just come in and destroy a region. Those are, you know, in those catastrophic disasters like storms and floods, even though there's no way to specifically attribute any one given event to climate change, we all know that these types of events are happening more regularly because of the way that the Earth is getting warmer, warmer air holds more moisture, and heavy precipitation events are more common in the past, and South Asian countries in particular are vulnerable. So I thought we could start by, Priyali, could you tell us a little bit about how attuned communities in India are to those threats, and what actually happens when those sort of big weather events happens and regions get flooded?
Okay, so I'm going to talk a little bit, more specifically about the state called Assam, which is in the east of India. So Assam and Bangladesh are bordering states, in the sense Bangladesh has, they share a border. every year, the state of Assam experiences floods. There have been 12 major floods, let's say, from the 1950s, but these are like major floods I'm talking about, 12 major floods. But every year we have thousands of people killed, thousands of people displaced. We have a lot of land which is destroyed due to flood. What is the consequence of that? When you have displacement, when you have land destroyed, when you have people moved into refugee camps, there is whole a lot of agricultural land which is getting completely destroyed, which is turning into silt. People are losing their livelihood. People are forced to live in refugee camps. There is no compensation package which comes in immediately. Even if it does, maybe it's not enough for these people to actually, support themselves to get back to the kind of lifestyle they had. There are very few rehab and compensation packages which reach out to these people. I want to talk a little bit about the refugee camps where most of these people are pushed into because of these disasters. Women especially have a very tough time at refugee camps. Talking about health and sanitation issues, there is barely any kind of proper facilities. And we are talking about hundreds and hundreds of women and children who have to survive in these refugee camps. There are incidences of sexual harassment. So when natural disasters happen, it not only impacts people, let's say, just in one specific way, but it has a multifaceted impact on them. Like I said, we discussed, it takes away their livelihood. And we were talking about this yesterday during the happy hour discussion, how women get more disproportionately impacted by, say, natural disasters like floods, because every time a family or a household loses their economic source of livelihood, it is the men who easily migrate, but the women have to stay back and provide for the family. So they are forced to look for other opportunities, other sources of livelihood, which means they could be forced to do domestic work. They could be forced to do labor, which they are not used to, which impacts them emotionally and physically. They get more vulnerable and susceptible to being lured by traffickers, but I think that's something which we will talk about a little later.
The flip side of that sort of like calamitous weather event is the sort of slow-moving climate change disaster. And that was sort of the other big thing that came up is sort of defining the climate change disaster in those two ways, right? So the big thing that totally like wrecks a village and creates all these horrible downstream effects, but also the sort of slow-moving things like drought, which is, the mechanism is pretty straightforward. Warmer temperatures mean more groundwater, surface water is evaporating, and that means drier land and more difficult situations for a lot of people, because obviously having drinking water, potable water, and water to farm is key to livelihood across the country. But recognizing and addressing disasters that develop incrementally like that can be really challenging. I think we sort of saw that here in California in 2015, where there was this slow-moving disaster on the way, and then all of a sudden we realized how bad it was. And Ian, you've been covering environment in California for years. I guess what one thing I'm curious is if you think we learned anything from 2015, or is the story going to kind of disappear and then only come back again if something disastrous happens? And just could you talk a little bit about what it means to face that sort of slow-moving climate change disaster?
Sure. So what it means to face a slow-moving climate change disaster in California, first of all, many parts of California have been overusing water for a long time, and then the drought comes along, which is that natural cycle, and then there's climate change on top of that. So it's all those factors are making the water crisis more severe in some areas of the state. And reporting on the drought and climate change the past few years, I've focused both on the impacts to snow and ice in the mountains, to surface water supplies, and also groundwater. And one of the, in focusing on the people who are most affected, often it's poor, predominantly Latino, and their neighbors have more wherewithal to drill deeper wells. For those who are in California, I may not be telling you anything new. It's sort of the backdrop of all of this disaster in the Central Valley. But it's a problem in the sense that there are various state and county programs that focus on helping some people, but they aren't uniform across the state. For instance, just recently, I did a story about a couple in the San Bernardino Mountains, and their well is just about going dry. And the reasons are primarily climate change, because those mountains are much drier than they used to be, so that it's just not getting the recharge for their well to function there. And unlike some other parts of the state, there's no assistance available. So they're a retired couple. They need to put $4,000 into it. And, California in many ways is sort of insulated or people through their wealth are a little bit able to deal with these climate-related disasters a bit more easily, but it's important that there be some type of a system better than it is today, I think, to assist those people. And so I've focused in part on telling the stories of people who are vulnerable.
It's interesting you say that, because I think that California is fairly insulated in that way. I mean, there's so much wealth here. And I think it might be useful for you to talk a little bit about the Sahel, because a lot of what's happening in terms of the actual climate impact is similar, but how it's affecting the people is probably dramatically different because of how much more money we have here to manage that. Can you talk a little bit about what the desertification of the Sahel looks like on the ground?
Maybe I'll just quickly introduce the Sahel region to people, because even people who really enjoy geography sometimes don't know what it means. It's an ecological zone. It's a transition zone. It's basically the border of the southern border of the Sahara Desert, and where it transitions into savanna. It stretches from Senegal and Mauritania in West Africa. It stretches across the widest part of the continent, so it touches parts of Ethiopia and Eritrea. Some of you will know about the Human Development Index, and that includes life expectancy as a proxy for health, education, and income. And so many of the countries in the Sahel are at the very bottom of the Human Development Index. So these are the poorest countries in the world. And this is a case where when you hear about climate change affecting the most vulnerable, this is on a regional level, this is playing out. The region was the first to experience man-made climate change, and the first time it sort of showed up on the map was in the Sahel in the 70s with a series of droughts. And they've always had a lot of variable rainfall, but there were prolonged droughts in the 70s and 80s that were followed by famine. And this continues. So I think in the last 6 years, there have been three major droughts in the region. And what the Niger president, Mahamadou Issoufou, said, he's basically trying to decouple drought from famine, because the droughts will continue, but they're trying to build up a national initiative for food storage and such. I think it's the contrast between Priyali's stories of flooding from Bangladesh and eastern India. I think it's a very interesting contrast. These are slowly unfolding ecological. This is a slowly unfolding ecological disaster. There are about 32 million people who are food insecure, and about 7 million people in the region who need emergency humanitarian aid. And meanwhile, the UN Office for Coordinating Humanitarian Affairs is at It's about 30% of their budget for humanitarian response in the region. So if I can say one other thing about the Sahel region, it is also the part of the world where there's unprecedented population growth, and that's basically due to, fortunately, as a public health person, mortality rates have come down around the world, including in sub-Saharan Africa. But in most of sub-Saharan Africa, fertility stalled. If you're familiar with the transition, the demographic transition, basically it's not really playing out there. It's stalled at fairly high levels. And so Niger, at the center, just north of Nigeria and at the center of the Sahel, has a population growth rate of 3.9%. And so in this context of severe food insecurity, of projections of climate change having a negative impact on the ability to grow crops and raise cattle, it's the, you know, by middle of the century, it's projected there will be almost three times as many people living in the region. At the same time, it's harder to grow food there.
I wonder if you guys could all sort of share your experience. Ian, you kind of alluded to this a little bit, but how it looks on the ground for both the sort of different levels of socioeconomic classes in these places. So how you were talking about how the poor in California are harder hit. And Alicia, I mean, in the Sahel, obviously people are much poorer across the board, but there's probably still some different economic classes, and I'm sure it's the same in India. So any of you guys can start and jump in, but I'm curious what that looks like in each of these three places.
Yeah, and I've really looked quite a bit at that issue in the past year in focusing on groundwater in several different parts of the world. And one aspect of what we found in a number of these places where aquifers are being depleted is that there are the larger farms that have the funds to invest in drilling deeper for the most part, and there are the people who are left with dry wells. And it's similar in California, it's similar in India, the same in Morocco. We found people who had entirely run out and had gone quite deep. In India as well, family was going into debt, drilling deep wells that didn't find any water in the end. And so in place after place, we were seeing a really similar pattern in terms of the poor being the first to suffer from this problem of groundwater depletion and not having the assistance to deal with it. And I did pass around my computer with some of the photos of these different places. You can see the farm in Morocco that used to have an orange grove, and that family has gone on to doing odd jobs and selling what they can in the market. The Indian family that's in Maharashtra, the young men in the family have left to go to the city. And so in small ways, I think these issues are driving migration within countries as well. And I think obviously those are important stories to tell, and sometimes they kind of go under the radar.
Priyali, can you talk a little bit about that? Because that seems like it sounds very similar to what you've seen, where the poor people are forced, the poorest people who are hit by climate disaster are forced to learn new trades and sort of like migrate into new places. And can you talk a little bit about that?
I mean, given any situation, it's really obvious, and it's that the most marginalized get the most affected, right? So, be it natural disasters or climate change-induced displacement, the people who are poor, food security issues hit them the most. They will not have immediate access to proper food nutrition. They would not have immediate access to clean sanitation. They wouldn't have immediate access to health care, whereas people who are a little better off, and they don't really have to be much better off also, people who are fairly better off have, say, enough reserves to go out and buy food or maybe get some kind of private health care. So in terms of how the poor get more adversely affected, these are major issues. I also want to touch upon a little bit what Ian said. He spoke about more and more people migrating to urban cities. In terms of socioeconomic conditions, migration can happen in two ways. So when people are affected by disaster or people are affected by events of climate change, if they are poor, then they will immediately migrate to, say, something which is a city or a town which is close to their space. That might not provide the best opportunities, but if they are a little better off, they would migrate to more urban cities. I was actually talking about socioeconomic impacts and migration to Roger Mark D'Souza of Wilson Center, and he told me once that it's very important to understand that people who are better off have the opportunity and the resources to migrate. But people who are actually poor and have no resources, they have no other option or choice but to be left in the worst of conditions. So,
yeah, I have heard that anecdotally as well about the people who are better off being able to move, and it makes sense. I mean, I've been following the migration into Europe over the last few years. There's a good series in the New York Times, I think it was by Thomas Friedman, about people moving from the Sahel towards Europe. And the UN estimates 60 million people moving out of the desertified parts of sub-Saharan Africa by 2020, which is hard for me to believe, but I think I want to go back to the issue. So my passion is in population and family planning. So if I may, I want to just point out that there are a few ways to slow population growth. Nobody wants to see the first way, which is that mortality rates increase. And the other way is through decrease in fertility. And that happens by, two ways. Voluntary family planning, of course, has an important impact. Also, educating adolescent girls, and that's through two mechanisms. First, they're more likely to start bearing children later. And secondly, they're more likely to navigate using contraception. So I think we talked about this a bit yesterday, but poorer people have a harder time sort of overcoming barriers to access family planning. And in the context of the Sahel, where there are almost 5 million people displaced, at the same time that people will be more likely to want family planning because they're displaced, I've never been to a refugee camp, but from the pictures I've seen, I think most women wouldn't want to have a child there. And this has been said in interviews as well. So at the same time that people are more likely to want to space or stop having kids, it's harder for them to access family planning. And the wealthy, however, always have means to access contraception. Even in places where abortion is highly restricted, wealthier women can access a safer abortion. And the last thing I'll say is that there's this concept of, through education, family size falls sort of automatically, and it's not the case. I tell the joke of the co-founder of this initiative, Malcolm Potts, has a million letters after his name. I think he has every degree known to mankind, but he says it doesn't affect his sperm count. So just by getting educated, it's not enough. What it means is that people can jump through the hoops to accessing contraception.
To go back a little bit to the question of sort of what it means to be forced into migration, I want to bring up this bigger topic of climate change, refugees in general, and sort of, I guess my question is maybe directed towards Priyali, but you've sort of reported on this debate about whether or not people who are driven from their homes and go to maybe have a little bit of the means to try and seek a better life, so to try and go to Europe or something. There's a debate over whether or not they should be given the status of refugee, right? And that's a sort of politically fraught decision. Can you talk a little bit about what it means to be in that situation and not have that status, and just sort of share a little bit about what that debate actually looks like?
Right. So, a small little caveat, even as a journalist, I have a bias on this issue.
Yeah.
So I'm going to talk a little bit about climate change-induced migration, a little bit of it from India, Bangladesh, and then maybe compare it on the international level in terms of the Europe migration. So every time there's, say, a climate change-induced natural disaster, it leads to migration. And what does migration lead to? It leads to conflict, because there are other people who are coming and occupying your land. There are other people who are coming and getting access to your resources, which are obviously very limited because of the growing population everywhere. So that leads to conflict. There has been a continuous migration happening from Bangladesh to India. And Bangladesh is obviously a climate change hotspot, which has a lot of its, you know, land being destroyed because of flooding. So it's obvious that these people are migrating to India. So they migrate to a region in India where there's every year not just flooding, but there is also increased amount of lives lost because of conflict between the Bangladeshi migrants, who are of a different religion, and the indigenous people in India of that region, who are also of a different religion. So there are lives lost not just because of climate change or natural disasters, but there are lives lost also because of the conflict which arises out of this issue. Obviously, because refugee status is not granted to these people have to continue to live under fake identities, which is a problem. If they live under fake identities, they don't get access to any kind of facilities or social benefits. They have no access to food rations or anything. So most of these Bangladeshis refugee or migrants who come into India, they actually migrate to other cities and start working as domestic workers where they are completely exploited. On the international level, the Europe refugee crisis, though most of the refugees are from Syria. When I was reporting in Hungary-Croatia border, I did see a lot of refugees who were South Asians, who were from Bangladesh. They don't want to be noticed as being from Bangladesh because they would be singled out and they would probably be asked to leave because even under the UN Convention, the 1951 UN Convention, refugee status is only granted to people who have to migrate because of persecution, but not because of climate change. So a lot of these people, actually, when I spoke to them, they said that via economic migrants. They were working in, say, Turkey or Greece, and now they're wanting to move to Europe. But just calling them economic migrants, I think, is also unfair, because why and how does the economic migration happen? Because they've lost their livelihood back home, which could be and mostly is in countries like Bangladesh because of flooding or climate change. So their economic migration is taking place because of climate change. And if the UN Convention on Refugee Status is not or is failing to recognize climate change migrants as refugees, then maybe there's a problem there, because as figures or as research or as data is suggesting, we are going to have 50 million to 200 million climate change-induced migrants by 2050. So that's going to be a huge population. And if we are not looking into addressing this issue, we are going to have lots of people without proper access to any kind of social benefits, any kind of health care, and yeah.
And I think in addition to that, as you've reported, there's all these sort of downstream impacts too, right? That creates these cycles of poverty and personal danger. And I thought it was pretty, I was really shocked to read about the human trafficking of climate change refugees. Maybe just to kind of continue, could you share a little bit about that?
Sure. I mean, this is all really connected. So like, when you come in as a migrant, or when you're the displaced population, when you've lost livelihood, you immediately look for other sources, right? Because you're looking for survival, and you basically cling on to anything which gives you hope. So I was doing this story in Assam where every year, like I said, floods occur, and the girls and the women in the refugee camps have pretty much no other option but to start thinking of other ways of livelihood. So that whole belt and that whole region is full of traffickers, and they recognize this vulnerability of these women and these girls, and they understand that on the other hand, in the urban cities, there's a huge demand for domestic workers. So they tell these girls that we are going to give you the option of, you know, a good income. We are going to give you an option of a good livelihood. Would you come with us? So basically, it's luring these people, and they take them there, and they actually end up as bonded laborers and bonded slaves. They're not paid. They are cut away from their families. They have no way of getting back. So it's a cycle. And what's worse is that maybe a few years later, if some of the girls actually get managed, if they are rescued and they go back to the same place where they come from, they fall into the same cycle because the government has failed to give any kind of good rehabilitation program to these girls where they are provided with any other kind of vocational skills that they can support themselves. So the next time a flood happens or the next time they lose whatever they kind of managed to get in the next few years, they get into the same cycle. And then they say, oh, maybe it's better that we go back to the city and at least get a plate of food. So,
yeah, it seems like one of the big tragedies of climate change is that it totally destroys social structures, families, communities. Alicia, when we spoke on the phone, you mentioned that climate change in the Sahel is eroding the social structures that would historically make it easier to get through a difficult time. And I was hoping you could talk a little bit about what that is or what that used to look like. So in the past, what communities there, how they could support each other, and how these ongoing droughts and famines are tearing those apart.
Yeah, thanks. I think there's the term resilience, it's a little bit of a buzzword, but from what I can understand, like the U.S. Agency for International Development has a huge resilience initiative in the Sahel. They have another resilience initiative in the Horn of Africa. Basically, people who come up with these initiatives realized that despite the development investments, if you will, there wasn't much change happening. And in the Sahel, it's because it's just this persistent series of droughts and amongst a very, very vulnerable population. I think it's important to recognize that in that part of the world, as in other sort of difficult, geographically difficult regions, I mean, difficult to thrive, the people are inherently resilient or else they wouldn't still be there. So they have these mechanisms for coping, whether it's, you know, moving with their herds over, you know, through annual cycles. There are very, you know, extended families and a very strong social support system, but there's some evidence that that's getting eroded. There's a picture that really caught my attention from Chad after the drought, I think in 2011, where it showed women putting sticks in the ground in termite holes, and they were basically luring the termites up so they could take the grains from them. So there's the mechanisms that have been in place that have allowed people to thrive to survive have are being eroded, and there's just evidence that, like, the diversification of livelihoods that I think Ian spoke to earlier. Historically, there have been smallholder farmers, and then there have been pastoralists. And over the last few decades, more and more parents are encouraging their children to try new things. And so now there's not this divide, you know, you're either a farmer or a herder. People are trying new things. They're also sending their children more and more into cities to try to find paid work. My colleague wrote a paper called Niger, Too Little, Too Late, and I told him it was pretty dire, but he has the experience of being the first American who was heading up Family Health International in the 80s. They were the first people to get USAID funding to address HIV/AIDS in Africa, and he said he was really proud when he got this first grant to work with sex workers in the slums in Nairobi. He did a calculation that showed that what the international community was putting in for HIV/AIDS in the early 80s when there could have been some real impact on the disease. The annual support for HIV/AIDS was equivalent to one day's support in 2011. And so we have this story of this crisis that people could see coming, a sexually transmitted disease. They knew it was, I mean, it was deadly at the time. They could see it coming, but the international support wasn't there. And so I think, you know, as many of you are journalists, an important part of your work could be getting attention to the Sahel region or another, you know, other places that are being very hard hit by climate change. You're talking about millions of people affected in Bangladesh and India. There needs to be an investment in it now so that it's not trying to pick up the pieces afterwards.
In California, I think it looks a lot different because I don't think people who live here, the U.S. doesn't have the same sort of strength in community and family, I think. I guess what I'm wondering is, Ian, could you talk a little bit about what sorts of recourse there is for, say, a small rural farmer who lost his livelihood here? You know, I don't think they have the same sort of family support network. Is there a government? Is the government helping? Like, what can they do?
Yes. What sort of resources are available for those who may have a dry well or suffering other effects of drought? I wanted to say, first of all, just in listening to what Alicia and Priyali are mentioning, that it really strikes me as super important, you know, the work as journalists of disentangling what are these complicated interactions between climate change, other social problems, to try to shed light on kind of these nuanced pictures of what's driving both conflict and migration. There's so much happening out there that probably we're just starting to scratch the surface as far as storytellers doing documentary work out there. And in California, it's as for the question of what assistance is available, or you know what are the situations that people are facing. It depends on the area. And I spent some time in the wine growing region of Paso Robles. In that part of California, there are a lot of people, small ranchers, people who live among the vineyards, who have run out of water and really don't have any type of assistance. So they just need to get water through a hose from a neighbor or think about how they can save up enough to drill a new well. If they're at 300 feet, they might need to go to 500 and to think about, you know, just what it means for them. So, you know, they're not struggling to put food on the table necessarily, but it's a difficult economic calculation for them to figure out how to deal with that. And especially in these small water systems or people who live outside of municipalities, it's going to be an issue for years to come.
Yeah, well maybe before we open it up to questions, because we're sort of getting to that point, we could talk a little bit about what both of you guys were talking about, which is essentially how to cover these stories. I mean, I think there's a whole bunch of questions I could ask you to sort of pick your brains and learn how you cover the stories. But I don't know, maybe Priyali, you could start and talk a little bit about how to actually tell the stories of people who are in these very sort of, you know, sketchy situations where they're being trafficked or are on the move and are maybe hard to keep in touch with. I'd be interested to learn how you got connected to those people and how you kind of kept in contact with them to tell their stories.
I always say that one of the biggest resources as a journalist is to be locally connected to the local NGOs. That's very important because those people are doing actually a lot of good groundwork. So, but also, as a journalist, you need to be a little skeptical about what the NGOs tell you. So you have to pick and choose. And be able to kind of balance it out and see what's the real story there. So,
well, maybe without naming names, you could tell us like what you actually mean.
So let me just like give an anecdotal story. So, I mean, I told you about how traffic girls, if they're not given the proper rehab scheme, can actually fall back into trafficking. So I was interviewing this girl who I actually connected through an NGO. And she was talking to me about how she was trafficked when she was 16 years old because her father had died in the flooding. And her mother basically was uneducated, and they had no way for any kind of livelihood. So she actually got trafficked, where she was not only sexually harassed by her trafficker for 6 to 7 months in this small little placement agency room. Then she was sold to a family where she was also harassed. And then she was rescued by this NGO, and the NGO kind of placed her back in her state. And when I was talking to her, she was back in the city. So I said, and she was constantly during the interview telling me that she has to go back, she has to go back. So I'm like, why do you have to go back? Like, what's the rush? So she told me, don't tell them that I told you, but I have to go back to work. So she came back to the city again, and she was again employed by somebody else where she was working as another domestic worker for pretty much, so I would call them domestic workers who are not getting paid and who have no access to any kind of facilities, bonded slaves. So even though the NGO was putting me in touch with her and was trying to help me get the story, there were things which I was not being told. So you have to be a little careful about the story you get and about the story you tell. So that's one thing. Social media is another great way to stay in touch with your contacts and sources. So once you make contacts, once you make you get connected with them, everybody is on social media these days. Everybody has. I met Syrian refugees who are on Facebook, and I'm in touch with them. Everybody is on Facebook. So that's a great way to stay connected. And maybe if you want to go back and do the story, track them as to where they are now. So maybe you interviewed them in one location, and after 6 months, you can interview them in some other location. So, yeah.
Maybe you could talk a little bit about how to cover a slow-moving environmental issue. I mean, as an editor, I know it's often really hard for me to, you know, take stories that are these kind of like incremental things. And I'm curious how you find compelling stories and, keep an ongoing disaster that's moving very slowly in the news.
I think there are opportunities to shed light on certain aspects of the larger, long developing and moving story. So, for instance, in California, we had the hottest summer in history, and that was an opportunity to go out in the community and look for some of the people who were affected by that. And that's actually how we came across that couple in the San Bernardino Mountains. Was looking around for, you know, which areas have we not reported on yet where there are people with groundwater problems, and in the mountains, you know, in particular, there's really that link to climate change.
Yeah, I was going to say I'm pretty bad at pitching stories. I'm more of like a operations person, but I did get something published. It's called Green Sex, and the subtitle was along the lines of how family planning can contribute to climate change. it is, I think, the slower and the bigger the disaster, the harder it is, excuse me, to get people's attention to it. And there was a sort of a social science study where they showed a picture of a young girl and said, what was her name? You know, this is Amber. She's hungry. And how much will you give? And people wrote down a figure. I think it was around a few dollars that they would give to help feed her. And then they told the same story of a girl, but they didn't give a name and they didn't show a picture. And how much would you give? And people said they would give less. And then they said, well, by the way, there are millions of girls just like this little girl, who need food, so how much will you give now? And people give even less. And so I think, I'm sure the journalists here will know better than I how important it is to tell stories of real people You mentioned the mission, so I think the way you word things is very important. And you mentioned the mission of our organization. We're not an organization of a project, but we have a mission statement, and we first came up with it right after a big conference we had at UC Berkeley, and it was to help avert this mega catastrophe. And we heard from somebody at the Gates Foundation that doesn't sell very well, and even though, as the UN defines a nutrition crisis, most of the countries in the Sahel region have been at nutrition crisis levels for over a decade. So we've reframed it, and we're helping to build the local capacity and the evidence base necessary to overcome the disaster. I don't know if I've addressed your question. I think one other thing about reporting from the Sahel is that it's there are multiple crises going on, and so for example, I'm very passionate about teaching adolescent girls basic life skills, and that could be in the classroom or through more innovative practical approaches. But in northeastern Nigeria, as I'm sure you're all aware, Boko Haram is like wreaking havoc. There are millions of people displaced within Nigeria or over the border. And so at the same time, we recognize the importance for doing this. There are forces actively fighting against it and making it difficult for people to carry on that work.
Well, since we've got some time for questions, if anyone has any, so let's. I'm supposed to take people with blue badges first. So,
I have one.
Okay. Uh-huh. Go ahead.
Okay. Great. Thank you all very much. This is really great. I have a couple questions. I think just the first place would be starting with the UN Convention on Refugee Status. So I'm unclear. Is a climate refugee covered under the UN Convention on Refugee Status a climate refugee? And if not, what's the definitional issue? And then are resources for climate-affected refugees being held until everything is worked out with the Paris Agreement? Is this why, the Niger, is trying to differentiate between issues related to climate and the drought and hunger, because the money for hunger is there and the money for drought is not. What exactly are those money flows? And also in the state of California, do we have specific drought-related state funding, climate-related state funding that is being directed in certain places and not directed in other places? You alluded to it, but I wasn't exactly clear what that was. And I was also wondering, in your stories, did you look at the displacement of water for fracking and the impact of it being where water is being directed to when you've got a smaller supply of water?
Let's take them one at a time. Okay.
I forgot the questions.
One thing I do want to say is I did report from the refugee camps in Greece. Uh-huh. There was Syrian, Iraqi, and Afghan.
Yes.
And definitely noticed that they tended to be, more educated than you expected, teachers, professionals, right, who clearly had some sort of resources, and that's how they were able to get there. But also, I was shocked as a journalist, based on the reporting that I had seen, the lack of reporting and coverage that had been on the preponderance of women and children that are there, and women who are pregnant, giving birth, have newborns. There was so little resources available for that whole spectrum, not just the preponderance, 70% of the population was women and children, not men, but that women have very particular needs that were going unaddressed, particularly this huge percentage, I felt, of pregnancies, loss of pregnancies, birth, and then newborns.
Okay, so I need to repeat the question, which I'm not going to do. But so what I will do is I think for the purposes of this, one of the questions that I think is worth, that we should address, is the clarification on the UN definition of climate refugee. So essentially the question is there a UN sanction climate refugee. Is that a thing at all? And if not, why not? And is there work on it, essentially? Yeah. And yeah, so let's start with that.
Yeah. Antonia? Hi. So I was in Greece this summer, and I reported from Samos and Athens. So I'll quickly talk about the 1951 UN Convention on Refugee Status, and then I quickly want to compare the conditions of refugees, say, in Greece, and climate change refugees elsewhere, which in no way means trivializing the situation of the Syrian refugees. But the 1951 UN Convention for Refugee Status actually clearly distinguishes between migrants and refugees. It says that refugee status can only be granted to people who are fleeing persecution. And obviously, under persecution, climate change is not accounted for. So under that, any kind of benefits and you know, how refugees can be later integrated into the social schemes of their asylum countries, that kind of benefit is completely removed from migrants. Also, migrants are at the risk of being deported any time if they are caught or if the government of the country where they are decides to deport them, which has also happened in many cases. So that's on the definition. The second issue which I want to address is the conditions. So because we recognize refugees of conflict, because refugees coming from Syria and everywhere else has gained so much international attention, it is good that their condition is being improved in the refugee camps. The refugee camps which I visited, women had their own trailers, which were air-conditioned. They had their own bathrooms. So there were, say, two families where women had their own bathroom to go to, and they were obviously upset because they were not in their country, but these are better conditions than, say, 50 women sharing a bathroom which has no lighting, where they have to queue up, where there are chances of sexual harassment, where traffickers are free to move in and out. So my point is that if recognizing climate change-induced and displaced people can make a little more difference or give them a little bit more benefit and improved a living condition, then maybe that should be accounted for.
The sort of the follow-up, I think, that is worth talking about is, this is just to the whole group, I think, but are any of you aware of specific government or international organization financial aid or resources that are set aside specifically for climate-affected, so climate change, basically survivors? I mean, the answer could be no. I'm just curious if you guys know of any. Not that I'm aware of. Yeah. Any other questions? Yeah.
Just sort of a follow-up to the famous question. Maybe it's for Priyani, but I'm wondering if the governments of, for example, Bangladesh or other countries very affected by and going to be affected more in the future by climate change events are lobbying for any sort of recognition of or change of status. And also, if you could just address briefly how, probably there isn't much of one, I would imagine, but how the government of Bangladesh is preparing for the mass migration of people within its own borders, and if they are developing their own sort of coping strategies or support within, you know, to the next 10, 15, 20 years.
So to repeat the question is, the question is Bangladesh or other particularly affected countries lobbying for climate refugee status? And then the second question is how the government of Bangladesh is preparing for the inevitable mass migration of climate change migrants that you had talked about earlier.
Let me begin by saying that I do not have too many details on this, but what I do, I'll tell you. For sure, I think Bangladesh is lobbying for this. I'm not sure if countries like India are, but Bangladesh definitely, because they understand and they recognize the fact that they're going to have lots and lots of migrants, not just moving out of their country, but also into their into other regions from the... I think the figure says that 50% of Bangladesh is only 5 meters above sea level, and in the next few years, 1 meter, I mean, the land, the water would be 1 meter above sea level. So, like, the threat is a lot. In terms of, when I was doing a story on this, I had spoken to a UN envoy on climate change as to, and I had questioned her, I forget her exact designation and name, which is a terrible thing about being journalist. You do the story and then you forget names and designations. So, but she told me that they are in talks about, you know, looking into whether climate change-induced displaced people should be included in the refugee status. But she also said that what it could mean, because what it could mean for countries which would have to actually absorb these people, how the governments would be so anti to that idea. And so it's a big debate.
Just to repeat the question. So essentially, what are the conditions like in the refugee camps in the Sahel region, and particularly for women and children, and how might they compare to those in Europe and other places?
So I explained earlier I've never been in one, so I'm not eligible to talk about it. I would want to say you mentioned that you saw a lot of children in them. So this is like the basic demography, but people forget about it. In countries, and so 99% of population growth this century will be in less developed countries, and that means that less developed countries have a very young population. So in most of the Sahelian countries, the majority of the population is actually under 15 years old. So just because of the basic demographic makeup of these countries, we will see more youth exposed to climate disasters. And the other thing is, like, we are humans are very unusual animals insofar as we have sex much more frequently than we need to get to our desired family size. And that doesn't stop when people are in refugee camps or they're displaced. And so it's not enough to, you know, to want to space your kids or to even stop bearing children. It's not enough to have that intention. You have to have the correct information and then the means to separate sex from childbearing. And so I think it's very important in refugee settings that along with all of the other essential medicines needed, that contraceptives are available and easily accessible to teenagers and to women couples as well, but especially women, since we're the ones that, you know, get pregnant and bear the, you know, the brunt of the efforts to raise the children.
Any other questions? Yes. A little louder. So the question is about the wall that India is building to keep out Bangladeshi refugees. I wasn't aware of this either. Is this a thing?
Okay, so maybe I'm ignorant about the wall issue, but I can tell you that the border is extremely porous, or has been until now, which is causing a lot of problem to India, and India kind of has had issues with it. And like I said, that it's led to a lot of conflict in the state of Assam. So if the new government, or the government that has been around for 2 years, and which is posed as a very nationalistic right-wing government, is trying to keep the Bangladeshi Muslims out by building a wall, I do not know. That's not a good thing. That's all I can say. Are they open to Hindus coming in from Pakistan and not Muslims coming in from Bangladesh? I'm not sure what that talks about, what that says about my government, but but seriously, I don't have much information about this.
Two questions. One is, can you talk a little bit, what the U.S. Military intelligence agencies are talking about climate migration and climate change as a security threat. So what exactly is the U.S. government doing in terms of providing aid to areas that you guys have been reporting on? And then also for Ian, I think here in the U.S. you see a lot of focus on climate migration going on in Alaska and mostly with indigenous communities. But what you've been doing, it's really fascinating. I've not had a chance to read that. But are you expecting to see more migration from rural areas and drought-stricken areas? You know, what do you see in the future? People being forced off their land, and especially those farm resources.
Okay, so we've got two questions. Let's start with the first one. So the question is that so we know that the U.S. military and intelligence agencies have already started to really think about and define climate change as a security threat. And I mean, we see it in the Sahel in particular, where there are there's a lot of political instability as a result of climate change issues. The question is, are these agencies, or is the U.S. government investing or providing support to these areas in order to mitigate that?
I know that the U.S. government, like through defense and also through the State Department Agency for International Development, is investing in the Sahel. I think generally our international aid to the Sahel is lower than other parts of sub-Saharan Africa, which again is lower than other regions in the world. But we had a conference at Berkeley. It was anyhow, we think it was somewhat successful, and it launched this initiative. We invited a colonel to come, and an army colonel to come and talk about a little bit about the security situation in the Sahel. And so any kind of military person on the Berkeley campus stands out like a sore thumb if you've ever been there. And I thought it was very interesting. I was emceeing the session, and We had him sitting next to a woman who's an advocate for girls' education. And so it was a really stark difference. He was describing, you know, that there's a lot of violent extremism in the region. There's a lot of civil unrest. And anyhow, all of a sudden, he basically, like, pounded his fist on the table, and he said, there will be no security in the Sahel until girls are educated and women are empowered. And it really surprised me. I think, and the issue of security, there are links, like the 9/11 Commission report said that, large numbers of uneducated and unemployed young men will lead to unrest. And it's kind of, you can imagine how that goes. I know that that's what, you know, in most of poor countries, there are large numbers of uneducated, unemployed young men. They don't have a lot of hope for the future. And so there are unfortunate pathways there that can lead people into being attracted by extremism. There's also unrest through the pathway of, in the Sahel, through the pathway of food insecurity. And we have on our advisory board the head of this large intergovernmental organization that's supposed to prevent drought and famine in the region. And I was like, why are you concerned? Why are you interested in family planning? Why did you put this in your resilience strategy for the Sahel region? He's the former minister of agriculture from Chad. And he said, people are not going to die quietly. There will be, you know, large manifestations as food gets harder to come by in the region. So there's a good book I would recommend called Africanistan, which is written by the former, like, whatever the French version of the French Development Agency. He was number two there, and he was very involved in efforts in, rebuilding Afghanistan. And so he's written a book about what parallels that he sees, especially in the Sahel region, with what's happened in Afghanistan.
The other question was directed to Ian, and was about essentially, is in the U.S. is climate change forcing or exacerbating a rural to urban migration?
And I think my best answer on that is I don't really know, but I think it's probably will be good to look at that issue closely, especially in farming areas where, you know, groundwater overpumping has been an issue for a long time. There's drought, there's climate change on top of that. Irrigated areas in the Central Valley, for instance, are declining, will decline more in the future, probably. And so some of those small towns could turn into ghost towns, maybe. And you had also asked previously about the assistance that's available. I don't have the figures. I would like to actually find those, though it's a good idea. But I do know that the state has emergency funding, which in certain areas, such as East Porterville, whereas you've probably read some of the largest numbers of, you know, hundreds of families that are out of water, the state does provide delivered water, and there are tanks available in yards sort of as a stopgap solution. And then there are grants to expand water systems into areas that don't have it. Of course, that takes several years, but people are starting to now be connected in East Porterville. Different story in the Central Coast, where people don't, you know, there is no program that's intended to assist them right now. So it's really a patchwork. But I think the question about trying to disentangle the climate and drought-related impacts from other factors is an important one. And it's complicated issue because agriculture is also changing because of the value of water, because of the value of labor, other factors, and much more high value crops, more almonds and other, you know, types of trees that can't shift as much but also have, you know, a lower per person labor cost. So all these things are affecting farm labor, and, you know, it's already a highly mobile group that may move around the state for different economic reasons. So I think it's important to look at those communities and figure out what are the factors that are leading people to move around. I do think it's likely that there are some people who are going to be on the move.
Any other questions?
brings a lot of different players, and some of them are enlightened, like your the Colonel and your event, and a lot of them are not.
So the question is, when the military and other sort of security apparatus end up taking charge of addressing climate change issues, what might they bring to the table that could be problematic?
Well, we talked. I think this is relevant. We talked yesterday about the term population control. I think a lot of people who, so I don't know how, you know, in the military sees the issue of population, but I think a very important piece of this is that I think people don't, either they don't recognize the relationship between population and environment and population and security, or if they do recognize it, they're afraid to talk about it because they think that it implies coercion, which is why I don't like the term population control, because control is usually seen exerted from the outside. I think one thing to recognize is that the two ways to slow population growth are also incredibly empowering to girls and women, which is through education and through access to family planning. We have a project that's funded by USAID in the Sahel. It's a project called Sahel Resilience Learning, and we're a subcontractor on it. We started a leadership program for emerging leaders in girls' education empowerment, family planning, and adaptation of agriculture to climate change. It's kind of ballooned out to food security. We've run the program, the leadership program, for Francophone Sahelian young professionals for the last few years, and we are scrambling to get it funded. I realize this is not the right audience to make the pitch, but I was told by somebody fairly high up at USAID that we should think about reframing the leadership program to be about, you know, security and good governance. And it is already about security and good governance through the mechanisms that I was just describing, and why population growth is related to that and why food security is related to that. But I feel, you know, it made me kind of cynical about how aid works. And anyhow, we'll keep going with the current themes of the program. But I don't have anything else to add.
Any other questions?
I'm sorry, I didn't get the question. So if you can just...
What do you think about the security agencies or the military involved in humanitarian response?
So I can speak about it from the Indian perspective. In India, the Indian military is pretty much the savior for everything. So anything goes wrong, it's the Indian military. The governments fail to address issues of natural disaster year after year. They make extremely poor embankments, which get breached every year. The floodwaters go ahead and kill people, and then the Indian military is called to rescue them. So the Indian military is looked upon as the savior, be it any situation, be it natural disasters or anything. So from that perspective, in aid work, but I'm only speaking in terms of the subcontinent here, so in terms of aid work, we highly respect the Indian Defense Forces, and they are like a last resort when the politicians have pretty much failed, which they usually do. So that, and but there's a good film, a good documentary film to watch. It's called The Age of Consequences. I've seen the trailer, and it's very promising. It's done by a U.S. filmmaker, and it talks about climate change and national and global security. Age of Consequences.
Well, thank you to our panelists for taking the time and for your insight. And if anyone wants to come up and talk afterwards, you are more than welcome to.